This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today. Welcome to We Are Libertarians for this week. I am Chris Spangle, and to my right is Greg Lenz, opening a beer, so I'm giving him time to get to the microphone.
Hello, everyone.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Chris.
And to my left is Gina Martinez.
Hello, hello.
Yay! She's back.
And she lives despite an end of summer cold.
Yeah, we just told everybody you were on vacation. So,
sabbatical.
I am going on vacation tomorrow, or next week, sorry.
She's got to get a good vacation in.
Yeah, I'm going down to New Orleans again on the 18th.
Oh, that ended well last time.
Yeah. Well, I got to go back and pick up the pieces of despair that were left behind.
Yes, and you are the worst thing to hit New Orleans since Katrina.
And Art, if you want to know more about Gina's life, please go to go to wal-radio.com and download Storytime with Gina.
Don't.
And I think it was the first episode we talked about your adventure in New Orleans, and it's quite the adventure.
Well, maybe we'll finish it up tonight.
Yeah. So you decided in like the worst possible week to take a break from Facebook.
Did I?
You did. Aww. You have missed so many things.
All of the world continued while my Facebook languished and died.
Yeah, so I put all the links, and I'll put all the links in the show notes here, but we've had quite a week on We Are Libertarians.
Yes.
And it's been a roller coaster of hatred and vitriol and success and winning.
All the winning. Hatred stems from success.
Right, yes.
Okay, so what specifically are we talking about, gentlemen?
See, because Gina disabled her Facebook account, she has absolutely zero idea what has gone on.
It's like I'm living in a vacuum.
Right.
So anybody on any of our listeners not connected to our Facebook is really going to appreciate me this week.
Yeah, so
she's in Facebook rehab.
Yeah.
No.
So it starts out with Thursday. You tell me that you have been published in Nuvo. So we must first say congratulations to you for being published in Nuvo. And we posted that on the Facebook page today, which today is Thursday of whatever date this is published.
Yeah, I had a blog on the guest voices. The rest of it's still kind of up in the air while they get their management structure formalized with Jim Poizner leaving.
Yeah, so Gina will hopefully, most likely, be a regular contributor to Nuvo, which is the news weekly in Indianapolis. So
they
it's
approached me about it, so we'll see.
Yeah. Not a big deal, nothing.
I mean, it's really, really cool, and I'm super blessed because it wasn't something I was looking for. It was something that found me.
Yeah.
And that does not happen in the real world.
Gina checks her email once a month, and it just happened that, like, the day before they'd emailed and asked her. Now, Greg and I were actually published for the first time today in Howie Politics Indiana, which is
nice.
Like the Indiana Politico.
Okay.
Yes. Greg covered the Ron Paul event that happened on Tuesday.
Right.
And I wrote a column about non-interventionism. And so you can check that out at, it's really for Howie subscribers. You can see Greg's piece at WeAreLibertarians.com. And here in the near future, we'll post mine as well.
Excellent.
So it's sort of like it's a subscription service, and he's been around since 1994, and it's like the political journal of Indiana, so it's really, really cool.
Yeah, it's a great service. It really is.
So, and those are like in any week that would be the high point.
Right.
But in this week, those are like meh.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Nice.
Oh, we're also Rands.
Yes, we are also Rands. Also coming in with an honorable mention is episode number 52 of We Are Libertarians.
All right.
That episode is the first We Are Libertarians episode to hit over 1,000 downloads and streams.
Damn, which one was that?
It was
Dick Cheney, right? Was it the Dick Cheney episode?
Yes. It was when we talked about Dick Cheney's daughter and Obamacare. And I don't know what it was, but
I was there, yeah.
It was very GOP influenced, so I bet we picked off some Republicans on that
maybe
one.
But yeah, that to me, that blows my mind. You know, we joke about having tens and tens of listeners, but
dozens and dozens.
Yeah, so we really want to thank everybody for sharing and spreading the word about the podcast, because that's the only way that we get to that point. Yeah. And it really means a lot to all of us involved. So that is a very cool point. But
yes,
in case you have not yet heard,
okay,
we interviewed Ron Paul.
What?
At the last We're Libertarians episode.
What?
Okay.
The Ronimal.
The Ronimal, yes.
Holy shit. And nobody called me?
It happened.
And he remembered Spangle on Wednesday night. Tuesday night. Yeah.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
He was like Spangle Bear. So clearly he listens to Storytime with Gina as well.
So last week, last Friday, we do Ryan Ripley and Joe Ruiz, who host our sister podcast where we talk about the media, called The Shill Report. We interviewed Ron Paul, and then we stuck it into the podcast and talked to him on Friday. Now, he had done a couple days before that an interview with Alexander somebody, what's her face from MSNBC.
Okay.
Wagner.
Alex Wagner. Yeah. She's on TV.
Good job that pays money and right. Fancy stuff.
She's on TV. People know who she is, and I'm dismissing her.
All right.
The sting must really, really hurt.
Yeah.
He says that he didn't like the interview and that it didn't go well, and then he went on to talk about how decent of a messenger Rand Paul is, and I hear that, and I take it, and I stick it into a story, and I tweet it out to Mediaite, Huffington Post, The Blaze, The Daily Caller, anybody who covered that story, and it just so happened that the Mediaite editor was sitting in front of his computer and saw the tweet, and put it on Mediaite, which went to Huffington Post.
Okay.
And then The Blaze.
Okay.
So,
number one story.
Yeah.
Okay.
We got like four or five times the normal traffic that we get to the website, which we didn't know the template that we use was so poorly set up.
Oops.
So it crashed the website repeatedly over the weekend.
Epic.
And yeah, I mean, it was a good problem to have, and now we know it's fixed. I mean,
it was, I was actually up in South Bend with Joe Ruiz, who Joe is the one that put this together, so he should absolutely get credit on
Hell
this
yeah,
podcast.
Hell yeah, Joe.
Yes.
Joe, well done, good sir.
And that'll happen twice in your life.
And no, because Joe is the man. They have already booked for The Shill Report Gary Johnson and
Jeffrey Tucker
coming up
what?
Too.
Yep. Right, I'm proud of you boys.
They're working on a few big names, and they have some really good interviews lined up. So make sure you get the show report.
Going on vacation more often.
If it sounds like we're bragging, we're not. We're just in disbelief because
these things just don't happen.
Right.
We're libertarians. Things don't go well for us.
We're like half.
Historically speaking.
Yeah. Right. We're like half a dozen nerds who just decided to write a website, and then all of a sudden you're on Huffington Post. You'd be excited too. Leave us alone.
Yes, you would.
So. You know, things are looking up, things are happening around here, so...
Well, it's all downhill from here, though.
Essentially.
It can't. We
promise not to suck so hard next time.
Yep.
Let's just go ahead and leave it there.
So, the part that we probably won't talk about on The Shill Report is that in the middle of it, Maya, in the group that we all have to kind of coordinate notes and swap stories and stuff, Maya's like, "That was the worst ever. I hate you. That sucks. Bah."
Really, Maya said something non-complimentary of your
and it was negative, and then it just progressed from
it
there.
It was social jihadism at its
it
finest.
It totally was.
Trolling doesn't even begin to describe what she did.
Did Spangle Bear lose his mind?
He was impolite, if that is any indication of how he actually responded.
Did you get any new cracks in your phone?
I didn't, but I did say I did use the F word a couple times.
Yes,
ooh,
Christ was
F-word.
Not pleased.
Listen, I'm a passionate man.
You went from guaranteed entry to heaven to a couple weeks in purgatory.
Maya will do that to you.
Yeah.
And if you're new to the show and you don't know who Maya is...
You need to look that up.
You need to go to theuncontrollables.com and check that out. So,
you are welcome.
Yeah. We'll explain Maya later. All right. Well, there... You know...
I mean, things are happening in the world, is the rumor.
Our own adventures, notwithstanding... You all right over there?
Yes. Gina's just the runniest nose. And
Gina's got a bit of a cold, so you're welcome, listeners.
I know. I'm so sorry.
Thanks for coming on. We much appreciate it.
I'm going to come blow my nose on your sleeve.
That is disgusting.
It's going to happen.
I'm going to blow my nose on your sleeve. Spangle.
The jello pudding pop.
Okay.
So that was a black joke, in case you were wondering.
That was not a black joke. That was a Bill Cosby joke.
I know.
Does it got to be black, Greg?
I don't know. Jello, Bill Cosby. I don't know. I just made a connection, went with it.
Yeah, you went with your racist connection. I see your Confederate flag on the back of your truck.
He is wearing camo, for the record, people.
When we last talked, President Obama was making the case to the Congress that they ought to fire missiles at Bashar al-Assad, who is the leader of Syria. You probably know the story. Allegedly released chemical weapons on his own people on August 21st. And the world ever since has been pressuring. Well, not the world, just Barack Obama. That's about it.
Yeah.
And
John Kerry.
Well, John Kerry, but you know,
who served in Vietnam?
Really?
Just in case you were wondering,
I had not heard. Did he serve with distinction?
I actually don't think so.
No. Okay. Listen to you, Captain Switbo.
Somebody remind me.
Captain Switbo.
Votes for truth.
Never mind. So, the president last week, when we talked, and the week before, we couldn't figure out what was going on. We didn't understand what they were doing, and that has continued. We still can't figure out what is going on with Barack Obama and the White House, and I don't understand what they're doing whatsoever. Greg, tell us what has gone on that makes us feel that way.
Well, the president has been relatively unclear about his intentions.
Relatively.
Well, just a little bit.
I mean, I think absolutely he wants to make sure that Assad does not have chemical weapons anymore.
Right.
He wants to make sure that he can have street cred among the humanitarian crowd that has been a lot of his support, and then rebuilding our stature in the world. That was something he really cared about. But the way he has behaved has been so incoherent and so... I guess Bill Clinton nailed it in the 2008 primary when he said he was an amateur. He has behaved in the most amateurish way I have ever seen a president, and I think realistically the only way to sum it up is to say that he has no interest in foreign policy until it's forced on him.
Someone said today that his deliberative nature has betrayed him.
It has. It has.
He's a deliberative guy. Even the way that he speaks is very deliberative and...
You know, he contemplates a lot, and he mulls things over in his head, and he doesn't like to act quickly. But in the Middle East, there's no such thing as time. Time exists, but things turn into a powder keg overnight.
Oh, yeah.
And you cannot afford to not be certain of your policy. And I don't think he, quite frankly, has put enough thought into what his Middle East policy was going to be after the Arab Spring. I think he saw what he thought was a democratic uprising, and it has taken a turn for the negative.
Well, I think we all saw that, though, yeah. No, wait John a second. I had heard reports. And
Gina's like, I was listening to the radio, and...
Yes, radio still has news too. NPR's there. NPR.
How do you get your news without Facebook?
I believe me, it can happen. Spangle, Christ! How do you think?
This is 1947.
When do you think the internet was invented?
When Al Gore was born.
Right.
You're huddled up next to your radio, going, "Gee willikers, what happened on Batman today?"
Right. I adjusted the bunny ears on my antenna, my television. Okay, so what I was going to say was, at one point, I had read reports that indicated that the the biological warfare had been accidentally triggered by the rebels mixing or some chemicals.
There is a report that they intended to not use chemical weapons, but and actually to like threaten it and to make it look like they actually had possession of them to force Assad's hand, and it ended up going off.
So at that point, if we are being triggered by the chemical warfare element and it wasn't even Assad that used it,
I think unequivocally now we're at the point we know he used it, but we don't know whether he used it in retaliation or if he used it first.
My thinking is that whether he used them or didn't use them, that does not change what the United States ought to do in any way. Like, debating, you know, the White House keeps pushing
that one, like, element.
Right.
Detail.
That here, we've shown this evidence. Here, watch this video from the CIA. That does not make any difference to me. It is tragic and it's horrific, but at the same time, horror goes on around the world.
Right.
And because you have used one type of tool for warfare, it doesn't make it always mean, it doesn't always mean that it's worse. You know, we have bombs. We have these
hydrogen bombs.
We have like these fuel bombs that explode and it burst flames over the head of the other troops, and it sucks all the oxygen out of the immediate area, including out of their entire body, and they vaporize.
Why do we have these?
Because that's the...
They hate our freedom, Gina.
Right.
And we love freedom.
That's the way that war works.
Freedom saving bombs.
Freedom
what them is.
And freedom.
Freedom saving vaporizers. What the...
So Barack Obama and John Kerry, they continued to go out and make the case, and it... I think if I'm remembering last Thursday, which was a long time ago, right, it was starting to go south, and the vote was really starting, the count was starting to look bad. And as of now, it's completely DOA.
It's dead.
Yeah. Even if some of the stuff that we'll talk about in a second hadn't transpired, it probably wouldn't even be getting out of the Senate, which a week ago we thought it was certain. So many members of Congress are completely thrilled that they don't have to vote on something that would have huge implications in 2014.
Oh, right. Democrats in the House are breathing an enormous sigh of relief right now, because 2014 is going to be a slaughtering if they had to go out there and vote for it.
Right.
I don't care what district you're in.
Because what it does is it has a chilling effect. So Democrats have been anti-war and staunchly anti-Bush policies when it comes to foreign policy. The Bush Doctrine, essentially, of going and freeing countries and...
Well, preemptive strikes.
Right.
Preemptive strikes and then trying to democracy build.
Right. And they would look like total hypocrites if they had to vote for this.
Absolutely, because it's hard to distinguish the difference between Iraq and Syria right now. We gave Saddam Hussein chemical weapons to use on the Iranian army,
right.
And Assad... I mean, the best thing, he has the best marketer or the best marketing, social media marketing and brand advising I've ever seen for a guy that used chemical weapons. His interview with Charlie Rose, he didn't come off like brilliant, but he came off as a sharp metropolitan guy, you know, definitely not the backwoods dictator type, hell bent on world domination.
Yeah,
the cosmopolitan dictator.
Yeah, he did. His wife had vacations in Paris and London all the time. He looked like an investment banker.
Have you ever seen his wife?
I've not.
His wife is beautiful. I think, is she British born?
Yeah, British born.
British born. They met when he was going to school for ophthalmology. He speaks fluent English because he spent many, many years in Britain. Living with her, having kids, and was just a part of this wealthy family. And his dirty little secret that, you know, people around him probably knew, but most of the people walking around wouldn't know, that his dad was this brutal dictator in Syria. And he was the second oldest son, and his older brother got killed in a car accident. Mm-hmm. So when... His father died in 2004?
Yeah, 2000, or no. God,
2000, I think.
Yeah,
it
2000.
Was.
Yeah, it was,
yeah, it was around them parts. And his dad died, and he had to take over. Well, he started to democratize the country. He started to loosen the reins and let freedom of speech take place. And, you know, the old guard that were around his father, the Dick Cheneys and the Paul Wolfowitzes of Syria, started to come around Bush Jr. And, I mean, Assad, I'm sorry, Freudian slip there, and said, you know, we have worked hard to get to this point, and you're not going to mess it all up for us.
Oh.
And so that's, he took over in spring, and that winter was called the Damascus Winter, I think it was the name of it. This is, I'm remembering a CNN piece on Who Are the Assads, which you can listen to. We launched a new podcast called Raw Audio Politics, and there's a national version and an Indiana version, and we posted this audio that I'm talking about in that feed, and he tightened down, and he's just been as bad as his father was. So,
but he's put on a really good face as
right.
far as engaging world leaders, joint, you know, taking
he's
got to
be charismatic, it sounds like.
Yeah, and he took an active role in the Arab League.
He dresses in a suit and a tie. He doesn't dress in like the, you know, he doesn't dress like Saddam
Gaddafi.
Hussein or Gaddafi, you know, sort of that, you know, wacky
regalia.
Dictator. Yeah, the just like Sacha Baron Cohen's dictator. You know?
Yeah, yeah. But then, I mean, then he invites I mean, great pick, Charlie Rose, has Charlie Rose in. Charlie Rose never gets agitated and is very good at getting his question in.
Right.
And he held his own. The entire time he held his own. When Rose starts telling him about the evidence that has been shown to the people's representatives in the House, he goes, is that, you know, essentially, is that the same evidence that George W. Bush showed about the weapons of mass destruction that weren't in Iraq?
Burn.
Yeah. And I was like, this guy's been coached and he's good.
As a witness, he created reasonable doubt.
Yep.
I mean, he really did. Yeah. As a witness, as you're watching it, if you can get back, get past, I mean, what kind of ruthless dictator has such a terrible lisp? But I digress.
That's an excellent point.
You know, he's like, I did not use the weapons. It was not me. Yeah. I didn't do it.
Yeah.
So if they attack
how
you,
how did he explain the other thousands of dead bodies?
He goes
that he is
if,
responsible for.
If
like,
the United States,
that away?
If the United States attacks us, expect everything.
Well, he talked about this.
Is that really what he said?
Yeah, it's John Stewart goes. That sounds like a bad travel, slogan.
He though isn't the issue. Expect everything. He's on the opposite side of Al Qaeda right now. I mean, by expecting everything, it's the terrorist threat. You know what I mean?
Well, it's an undefined threat, to be real honest.
It is, but he is the enemy of the terrorists right now. So, I mean,
sounds like he's making enemies left, right, and sideways.
Oh, he is.
But
like, if we threaten Assad, we will not face as staunch of a terrorist threat and repercussions as if we just backed out of this completely. If we did, the entire Muslim extremist world would turn back on us. They
if
absolutely
we backed
would.
Out, you think the Muslim extremists?
Oh, would? Yeah, because they're expecting our support right now. We're already running I forget what the guy's name is in Turkey. He's actually in charge of humanitarian aid in the U.S. State Department to Syria. He is trying to deal with the logistics of getting arms to the rebels. We cannot afford right now to stop supporting them, or they will turn on us on a
the
dime.
The anti-American sentiment in the refugee camps is really starting to bubble over.
Mm-hmm.
And one could argue that we've been providing arms to the Syrians, and that's what the Benghazi attacks were about a year ago. You know, think of what was stolen in Benghazi because
not to the Syrian rebels or the Syrian government.
No, we've been providing the rebels. You know, and al-Nusra is the strongest of the Syrian rebel groups that is fighting the Assad government. And it is a partner and an ally of 9/11, and I just find it's
a partner and an ally of 9/11. Are you saying
of Al Qaeda? I'm sorry.
They have been.
Sorry, I went all George Bush again there.
They've been claimed as Al Qaeda's arm in Syria, and then the Islamic Republic of Iraq, and this group is called the Islamic Republic of Iraq and Levant.
Levant.
Yeah, I know. They're a terrorist organization by the State Department. Have come out and publicly said that they support them and will provide them what they need. I mean, Iraq is dangerously close to the exact same outcome as Egypt, where it is going to be Sharia law. This is a really, realistically, the smartest thing the president can do is in public support the rebels and in private support Assad and let Putin know that. That is the most. That would be the smartest thing he could do.
Explain that. Why?
If you support Assad, Israel's not a threat. Or Israel isn't threatened, because we're going to get pressure if the Syrian rebels win from the Israeli lobby, and they tend to not talk to us a whole lot before they strike. They're not like the president who goes out on TV and says,
in a couple weeks, we're considering dropping bombs on y'all.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, that is just terrible. One, it'd be the worst poker player ever.
Right.
And then John Kerry letting things slip. It has been really bad. But if you support Assad, you get stability. Yeah. There's no good moral play, but you're making a play of a secular leader who's a dictator. He doesn't persecute people based on religion, but he is a dictator. If you support the ANF, the ANF is going to they're going to invite the Muslim Brotherhood in. They're going to try to establish elections, a government infrastructure, and then it will be Sharia law like what happened in Egypt after the protests. So that's the worst outcome for the United States, because then that will scare Israel. Israel will strike, and that triggers World War III.
Okay.
The smartest thing in the world to do is support the rebels publicly and privately talk to Putin and let it be known that we have no intention of letting the ANF take over Syria.
Wow.
I mean, but don't you have to pour weapons into the rebels to make that happen, though? And doesn't that change momentum on the ground in Syria?
You do, and then you also provide Russia with any kind of funds necessary and let it flow through them as support for Assad.
So now we're funding both sides of a civil war.
Yep.
That's not just a civil war, kid. That's a world war situation.
Or you let it do. The president did a smart thing by sending it to Congress, because regardless, it's going to need special funding.
This pisses me off, guys, because we're still funding World War III. For like every nation on the planet, we are providing the arms. So Halliburton's.
Yeah,
you know,
let's ask
the Boeings, the Halliburtons, the Lockheed Martins of the world.
Let's ask Captain McBombie Bomb over here, Mr. Captain Intervention. I mean, how do you square that with a non-interventionist foreign policy, what you've just said?
Oh, you can't. I'm just saying, if you want stability, that's the route to stability. You make the extremists not angry at you, and then you support through back channels the person who can provide stability and keep Israel. Assad's reasonable at worst. You can buy him off. You can do. He's easily influenced by making him look good. He's very vain.
What we have basically done the last week is we've legitimized a country that we spent years undermining.
Exactly. And I don't know if the president is this smart. I don't know if his advisors are this smart, but we...
Way to pat yourself on the back there, Greg.
Get it, Greg.
Hey, you gonna break your arm? I don't know if they're this smart to figure out what I just came up with.
No, this isn't my idea. It's not original at all. I'm just reading an article. I can't remember. I think it was in the New Republic. It was comparing the president to Machiavelli and how the most, or the best way to handle this type of situation in the prince is to come off as the good-natured moron. Because it makes people think that, oh, he really cares about all these things, but then behind the scenes, you understand that you need to be pragmatic and people would never suspect it of you. So the president looks like an amateur in public, looks like an absolute moron, but in all reality, behind the scenes, you let Russia own this, which is critically important. We don't want to own this. We're already got our hands in enough pots. Or, you know, we are all over the world right now. We can't afford another Syrian conflict or any conflict. Let Russia own it. Play to the vanity of Vladimir Putin. Play to the vanity of Assad, who wants to be seen on a global stage. Make it look like we're supporting Muslim extremists. And keep everything the same and keep Israel in the best position possible. By being dumb and appearing dumb, he is kind of keeping all the balls in play and we haven't been triggered into war yet.
Right.
So that's the argument for Barack Obama is competent, which is kind of interesting. It's an interesting thought.
Yeah, and it's not mine. I'll put the piece. I'll send Spangle the link. It's absolutely not mine because I am not capable of that thought level.
All
at least not
involved.
Without 5 to 8 beers in me.
Yeah, the New Republic is a liberal magazine, so they're trying to find some way.
They're going
to
defend them, but it was interesting. Right. You know, I'll read something that I disagree with because that's important. You know.
Right. So let's take the incompetent view now. The greatest foe.
Spangle's like, I'll handle that one.
I got that one. I got it covered. The greatest. Listen, we spent so many episodes. I'd say the first 45 episodes. I don't think we mentioned the president really at all. And that was in the middle of the 2012 campaign. You go back to listen to, and why would you, to all of the 2012 episodes, and we rarely ever talked about Barack Obama. We never were like, the president sucks. We just weren't that podcast because he didn't matter as much. I just am so irritated. I'm just irritated. It's like, I can tolerate wrong and effective, but wrong and ineffective and bumbling just irritates me for whatever reason. You know, it's just...
It's like indecision is worse than the wrong decision and then changing course.
Right. He just looks so weak. I just don't understand how he can be the greatest communicator of all time in the campaign, and then he gets to become president, and they lose every bit of PR savvy that they had during that 2008 campaign.
Well, most of his brain trust is gone.
Yeah.
Axelrod, I mean, the president quit becoming effective when Rahm Emanuel went to run for mayor.
Yeah.
He got healthcare through, he jammed it down, he threatened people. You know, Emanuel's an operator, but he's just attached enough to Clinton, he can play the moderate role. When Emanuel went out, Axelrod leaves. Robert Gibbs leaves, who is a critical advisor for him on a lot of things. He brought in Valerie Jarrett, who is a true believer. Reggie Love left. His brain trust is gone. And yeah. He's toxic now, so they ain't coming back.
Yeah. I mean, it really seems... Bob Corker did an interview on CNN yesterday that, you know, the speech was... Everybody who was in the room with him thought that he was going to give a speech that would give us some strategic point of view, and what he gave us was the exact same thing that he and Kerry have been saying for a week that has not been effective. And Bob Corker said he called McDonough, the chief of staff, and said, "You make it hard to support you." And Corker's a Republican, you know, and he's been one of the most outspoken proponents of all of this, and he just kind of went off on the president yesterday because... People like Corker are totally exposed now politically. So it has been amateur hour. The greatest through all of this, the greatest foe to the Barack Obama administration has been the hypothetical situation, not the Republicans. You know, the hypothetical situation in the middle of a campaign when he's asked in a press conference, "What would you do if Assad had chemical weapons?" And he hypothetically says, "Well, that'd be a red line." You know, Kerry has asked a hypothetical question about what would
he have to do to not strike?
To not strike. And, well, if he turned over all of his...
Weapons immediately.
Weapons to the international community, then we might consider it. And the State Department releases a press release almost immediately after that saying, well, that was a goof.
Oops.
Not policy. That was just an off-the-cuff remark.
But it gave him an out.
Yep.
It was a... We were headed for a strike.
Yep.
Right.
And that gave him... I mean, I don't know. I would be stunned if John Kerry makes that comment without at least having the conversation
somewhere
and
along
letting
the line.
It slip. Yeah. I mean, I'm very cynical, and I think a lot of things are played out. I don't see how that slips out. That is too big of a slip up to not be intentional.
But why not come out and... I mean, is it that they're too far down one... position.
It's the rebels is, I think, who they're concerned about.
Okay.
If you said, you know, that gave them the outlet, oh, Kerry, you know, because realistically they could can Kerry
right.
and then still make it look to the rebels. No, we're still on your side. We had a rogue actor and we had to get rid of him.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, because it did to me, it seemed like a broader thought that probably had been discussed somewhere, but they are so far down the war path that they can't just now come out and switch course again and say, let's try diplomacy before we strike. You know, and that gave them sort of an out. You know, John Kerry, he's experienced enough as a weasel to really pull that off.
Yeah. And he's not well-respected enough intellectually for that to come off as oh, he's just wily enough to pull that off.
Yeah. So, man... These hypothetical situations are just killing these guys. So how much of this have you heard? I mean, what is your reaction to all this, Gina?
I mean, I'm frustrated, as I would say much of the world is, because the people of Syria have been treated so poorly and, you know, murdered, mass murdered. Kids that were going to school to get an education were just shot down in the streets by Assad, from what I understand, and... And I'm not saying I've got it all figured out, but it's really tragic and ugly. And it seems like they are not the focus whatsoever in this situation any longer. The focus now has become, you know, what impact will this have globally and politically? And, you know, it's important to consider all of those things, but I feel like the bottom line needs to be getting help to those people, or otherwise there's not going to be a purpose for getting involved in any kind of strikes against Syria.
I don't think any kind of strike, though. I mean, it's not going to help then. It's just going to fuel the people leaving the it's just going to create more and more refugees, which is already, at this point, a situation that is just out of control.
But don't you believe that it would be so unbelievably small that it wouldn't, wouldn't warrant retaliation?
All right, let's talk... I mean, Barack Obama shouldn't make war because he's really, really bad at it. How, Greg, you, out of all of the We Are Libertarians gang, as our listeners just heard, you are the most strident supporter of bombing.
I am. I am a...
He's a big fan of bombs.
No,
he's a big
fan
of weaponized murder.
I am. I believe, no, I don't make any qualms about that. I believe in the NAP until hit, and then I believe in absolute devastation, because I think what's happened...
Upon retaliation.
I mean, absolute retaliation. There's a reason that Pax Romana is still known today, because the threat of the Roman Empire was so absolute that even thinking about hitting him, it was essentially ending your culture and civilization. I believe in that because I think war's been cheapened. I think that it's become what I talk about a lot. What's the virtue of a proportional response? You hit an American, you kill an American, a group of Americans, we're going to take out a strategic military operation. It is way too transactional. War should be so prohibitive, and the cost should be so high that it should be the option that absolutely nobody wants. And today I feel like it's the option people can't wait to pursue.
Yeah.
Right. But I guess my thought with that would be, historically as a nation, we have had a response where, like, let's say hypothetically some Japanese guys came in and dropped a bomb on Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And then we, like, hypothetically turned around and just fucking laid waste and nuclear bombed a couple other cities.
We did.
You would think that that would be an inhibitive factor.
It has
in the event
since.
That the psychology that you just described is going to be effective.
We have. We haven't been hit by another country since. We've been hit by Islamic extremists who believe we have imperialized their culture
but
in the Middle East.
We've still been in a rather war-minded state.
Oh, we absolutely have been. Yeah,
that's not because people have been attacking us. That's it's true. Because we
can find places to attack other people.
Well, right. And
Vietnam and Korea were about stopping communism.
Ideology.
Yeah.
We're in wars of ideology. We're not in wars of nation states anymore. We are witnessing ideologies butting up against each other that there is no reasoning out of it. There is no, well, maybe if we can offer Western liberal democracy and intertwine our economies as trade partners, there's a chance that we can not go to war together. That line of thinking doesn't exist anymore when you're trying to fight ideology.
I watched, I think the last weekend or the weekend before that, I watched the Pacific miniseries from HBO. And, you know, my grandfather was in the Pacific at Okinawa. He was, if you're familiar with the miniseries, he came in about where Sledge came in to the war. Almost 25% of that generation served in the military.
Most of them, yeah.
It was compulsory. They were drafted. But people like my grandfather lied about his age at 17 to get into the Marines.
Right.
And he wanted to be a Marine because he wanted to be the most badass fighter he possibly could. He wanted to be a warrior who struck fear into the heart of the people that attacked us on 9/11. And the rest of society wanted that for him. The rest of our nation mobilized for war. And we, as a nation, forget about it. And it's not that people fear our military less because our military members are less brave or less courageous, because that's not true. It's they don't fear our political leaders, and they don't think that Americans have the backbone for war, and we honestly don't. And there was an article in Foreign Policy a couple weeks ago that it's time to start showing the real cost of war at every single level. And that we'd have less violence in our world if America especially were exposed to the true cost of war.
Right.
And, you know, for decades they've been trying to stop the pictures of the flag draped coffins. You know, that's the cost of war. These decisions, you know, my article for Brian Howie was, you know, my great-grandfather was born the same day as the Italian-Turkish war ended, which led to World War I, which led to World War II, which got my great-grandfather's brother killed in Normandy. You know, there's real costs. And I think as a society, as a country, we've forgotten the cost of war. I don't think we do enough to support our military, because we want to turn away. We don't want to think about it.
Wait a minute. I don't think we do enough to support our veterans once they are out of the military, But I think that most of us hold military members with a certain level of deference. Now, do I think our government necessarily treats them like human beings? No, not at all. But I don't think there's a lack of respect for the soldier in this country.
No, I'm not saying that at all. And okay. I hope nobody misinterprets what I'm saying at all. We're at a point of perpetual war.
Right.
And we have to stop. Because when you go to war, just like Greg is saying, you go to war, the whole society gears up because it is such an egregious act that has been committed against your country or your area. You know, right. If you're an open borders person, it's not a nation state.
Whereas conversely, for like the last, I don't know, couple hundred years, it seems like we've been in a state of, like you said, perpetual war, and there is no gearing up. There is no amping up. It's just like, oh, we're dropping bombs somewhere. Yeah, we have been. I remember Desert Storm.
That's how you get things like the Patriot Act.
Yeah.
That's how you get, when you're in perpetual war, that's when, and they create this culture of fear, this culture of attack. The government has a vested interest in keeping that because that's when you're most likely to relinquish your rights.
Yeah. Woodrow Wilson had to lie. Woodrow Wilson won his second term 100 years ago because his slogan was, he kept us out of war. Our whole entire mentality in our nation was that we understand the cost of war. We don't want to go to war. We don't want to do this or that. I mean, we actively fought against our government saying that we don't want to go to war. And he won on that slogan. Now, the entire time he was gearing up for war and he was lying through his weaselly little scumbag Woodrow Wilson teeth.
FDR did the same thing.
And he did too. And you know, Woodrow Wilson then puts in the Espionage Act and puts people like presidential candidate Eugene Debs, who is from Terre Haute, Indiana.
The proud socialist history of Terre Haute, Indiana.
Yep, the Socialist Party of the United States. He was in jail for, gosh, a decade or two.
At least, yeah.
For what?
For speaking out against the war.
Yeah. It was similar to the Alien and Sedition Act.
Yeah.
Where essentially, you know, he was promoting, while the threat of National Socialism was rising, he was promoting it actively here to the point where even like Jack Reed and other American intellectuals fled to the Soviet Union to see the Trotsky and the revolution, right. The Bolshevik revolution in Russia. And they would go over there, they'd write about it, come back here, try to actively promote it here. And it became a serious issue for Wilson.
Yeah. And that's where, sort of the beginnings of what ended up with the Eugene McCarthy hearings, where they're blacklisting people in the 50s for being communists.
Right. I heard about the blacklisting, but I hadn't heard that we had a presidential candidate locked up for 2 decades for
Eugene Debs
from Terre Haute.
Eugene Debs.
Did they trump up some other charge? What did they get him on?
Treason.
Treason. Espionage. And look at what they're doing to Edward Snowden. Look at what they're doing Obama has used the Espionage Act more than any other president.
Against journalists.
Which is exactly what Woodrow Wilson did. And Woodrow Wilson locked up, you know, there was such an anti, because he was so effective at propaganda, he studied propaganda, and many of Woodrow Wilson's tactics for propaganda were used by the Nazis. Edward Bernays wrote the book on propaganda, and that was found on Goering's nightstand. The Wilson administration was horrific when it came to propaganda. And you go back and you look at the World War One posters, and you know it's the Germans are dressed like King Kong striking New York City, and they created this German anti-German sentiment. Let's go with that. And it was very, very destructive to the country, especially at a time when, you know, my direct ancestors lived in little towns in Indiana where they only spoke German because they were a generation off the boat.
Right.
You know, and German citizens were beaten to death because they were speaking German and they didn't know English yet.
Right.
There were internment camps for Germans in World War One. And just like the Japanese, you know, Germans were also interred during World War II, and it's not talked about that often.
If there was ever a case for anti-intellectualism, it would be Warren Harding. It would be Herbert Hoover. I think there's this distinguished air we give really intelligent presidents who come off as extremely well-spoken, very deliberative, contemplative. Wilson was president at Princeton before he was president of the United States. Hoover was president of, I forget what the university was, I believe, or an engineer.
Yeah, he was
an engineer. Sorry, not president. But when you're extremely smart, you have this idea that you can control the outcomes of an enormous society with so many different variables involved that you create mass destruction. Keep
yes,
in mind,
I have witnessed this phenomenon. Continue.
Yeah. So for instance, in Harding's case, Wilson's case, Wilson was watching progressivism really rise. That was the dominant thought: the state socialism, the central planning, the League of Nations, the one world government, all of these things. And he got delusions of grandeur that if he could just formulate the right framework, we could have the perfect society.
That's what the League of Nations was about.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
He really planted the seeds. He created the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve is
right,
just
charming.
The yeah, income tax.
The yeah. income tax.
Oh, that's the same dude who outlawed marijuana.
He
built him a gallows.
He was. he was
Woodrow Wilson also Woodrow Wilson, Democratic president, resegregated the army.
Okay.
Now Woodrow Wilson was born in Georgia, in Atlanta, and, you know, he was a boy at the end of the Civil War, and he came to power, and this, you know, great progressive resegregated the military. And it was, if you've ever seen The Birth of a Nation, which was a pro-Klan film, basically, I watched The Birth of the Nations, and my jaw just hit the floor. I was like, what is this? This is the most racist stuff I've ever seen.
But the intellectual thought was...
It was like the biggest movie of the time because it was pro-Klan, and he showed it in the White House.
The reason why, though, was that the smartest influencers in the United States were people who thought it was possible to create a perfect race, a perfect soldier. Everything could be perfected with human thought and skill.
That's where the earliest 20th
Welcome
century...
Welcome to the variables.
Yeah, the earliest 20th century eugenics movement was... I mean, Margaret Sanger, who founded Planned Parenthood, was her sole purpose was to eradicate minorities.
Yep, and low IQs, they were thought...
Right.
It is...
There's a clip of George Bernard Shaw that you can find on YouTube of him talking about, you know, you, sir... must come to this panel, and if you are of low IQ, you must justify to us why you should exist anymore.
Oh my God. Because you are of low IQ, you should defend yourself for your
life.
If
you can't explain why you are of worth in this world, you should be executed. George Bernard Shaw was one of the most monstrous human beings. So this earliest, the eugenics movement here in Indiana, they passed a eugenics law. And if you go to the Indiana State Capitol, there is a monument on the west side, sort of northwest towards the historical archives, where they celebrate the end of the eugenics movement. Because in Indiana, it was legal to kill people who were not of worth to society anymore. Indiana, especially.
Like anyone, or like doctors or medical professionals? Like who had
it? Was
they provide value to society, so
right? Medical professionals would make that.
What you're trying
decision.
To do is accelerate social Darwinism by filtering people out, by breeding the correct people. It's similar to the Hitler Youth, where they would have females that they considered of valuable genetic factors breed with the best warriors of the Hitler Youth, or the best soldiers, in order to try to create the perfect race. And like I bash Democrats a lot on this show, but at the same time, I feel like that movement still exists. Thinking
Creepy.
That the United States can play a role where we can perfect Middle East peace when it's a war of religion. Thinking we can influence. Trying to have your hand in everything and tweak outcomes is your downfall.
It's central planning. I mean, so this notion of, you know, it was perfected, unfortunately, by Adolf Hitler and the National Socialists in Germany. And, they just were the end outcome of what this belief system is. And, you know, it is not as barbaric now, but there is that impulse that continues on to this day that we can perfect society by tweaking little levers. There's a guy named Cass Sunstein. Cass Sunstein is he was head of, what was his title that Barack Obama gave him?
The czar of
information
and behavioral something.
He is he
professor
said,
at
yeah.
University of Chicago, I believe.
He said it was his life's dream to become to have this position, because he felt that if he could just get the right regulations in place, then he could get the economy back going again. He could nudge society. He wrote a book called Nudge.
And the idea was that progressivism has always been about force.
Right.
Sunstein got very popular in the last about 6 years because instead of force, he changed it to creating incentives. To give you an idea, to stop smoking, you would make it so prohibitive and such a complicated task to get a pack of cigarettes when you walk into a convenience store that you would slowly over time decrease that behavior and then attach social stigma to it.
He calls it libertarian paternalism,
mm-hmm.
which there's nothing libertarian about it whatsoever, because there is no central planning. And so he is the reason that we have had so many rules and regulations put into place. And when he was asked in a recent interview, you know, do you think that you put in too many? He said, I don't think we put in enough. So his role in the Barack Obama administration in the beginning was the head of information and regulation. And this is a man who is on record saying that he loves Bernays, he loves propaganda. The president recently appointed him as the person that is he's basically in charge of marketing Obamacare.
Oh, wow.
Okay. His role is going to, it's not that Obamacare is bad, it's just that you little brains just don't understand it enough. So we're here to nudge you into understanding Obamacare. The impulse to control healthcare is very scary when you understand the history of 20th century progressivism. The death panels is not a thing, okay? And by that I mean the intention of death panels, like the eugenics movement of the 20th century, is not in Obamacare. It's not there. What Sarah Palin was saying is stupid
but got made fun of.
The
precedent's there because it's cost-effectiveness, not cost-benefit analysis.
But do you remember when Kathleen Sebelius, the head of the Health and Human Services, had to make a decision to lift a regulation in healthcare so that a 10-year-old girl could get a life-saving transplant?
Yeah, I do remember reading that.
And that is because of regulations put in place. So that is fundamentally, you know, these are very important things to understand when you are looking at all of government. It is the impulse to perfect society at every level here in the United States. And the reason libertarians are non-interventionist is because we don't want to intervene in economic lives. We don't, your economic life, your personal life, and we don't want to intervene in the foreign affairs of others. We don't think that we can make the best decision for the person sitting in India or China or Brazil, because our government can't even make the right decisions for those of us sitting in Indiana or California or
Texas. They can't
make
the right decisions for themselves. Otherwise, they wouldn't exempt themselves from everything.
So, you know, it's
we're going to pass this law, but just so we're all clear, it doesn't apply to us.
We're not subjected to the Civil Rights Act because we're so enlightened and we're the political class. You know,
everybody is equal, but some animals, but some animals are more equal.
Yes, and I've said this probably multiple times, and you're probably bored of hearing it, but that phrase, don't amonetize the eschaton. It means don't assume that perfection is of this world. Don't think that you can perfect society. It is the most dangerous aspect of any political party, is that we know, I mean, realistically, we have this program that will work. The only program that works is leaving it alone. It's absolutely abstaining from control. And it won't happen until you start having people that adhere to libertarian values. And, you know, whether that's a step-by-step process or more of an overthrow, like a Kokesh type of advocate, what he advocates, that's when we'll really get rid of that risk.
Yeah, and there's two stark examples in history economically. Look up with Thomas Woods. He gave a talk, and it's in a couple of his books, I think, Why You've Never Heard of the Crash of 1920-something. Just go into YouTube, type in Tom Woods, Why You've Never Heard of the Crash of, and you'll figure it out, versus the great experimentation of FDR in the Great Depression. And the great experimentation of...
It was Harding's crash that roaring back, yeah.
Right, because they left it alone and they did nothing. And then FDR prolonged the Great Depression another 10 years because he said that, you know, it's a quote, I'm going to pull the levers of the economy. I'm going to this grand experimentation. And we've seen that with Bernanke and the Fed and our Treasury secretaries.
And you know who that all goes back to.
And Bush and Obama both. And it's happened under Paulson, and it's happened under Geithner, and it's happened under all of them. This grand experimentation means our jobs reports still suck, housing still sucks, education has a bubble that's about to burst, and none of us have any money in our pocket.
There was, I mean, and I know you're not a huge fan, but there was one president who absolutely abandoned that, and that was Ronald Reagan. He appointed Paul Volcker at a time when we had 21% inflation or 21% interest rates, year-on-year inflation rates of around 15%. And in fact, if you measured inflation the way they measured it in 84 or 83, it would be at 11% annually.
Sure.
Instead, they changed the way they measure it. But Volcker, realistically, will never be able to get back to a gold standard. I mean, it would take a long time.
Right.
Instead, he just targeted the price of gold. As the head of the Federal Reserve, when prices got high, he tightened things up a little bit in order to pull money out of the economy. When prices got low, he'd tweak gold prices, he'd tweak it a little bit, and he did price targeting, and that's how you can do it effectively. And Reagan had very strong economic growth and never higher than 3% inflation for 8 years. There's a reason he's remembered as reverently as he is.
Yeah. So, Gina, are you like Kyle Broflosky, and you're going to end this episode, I learned something today?
Yes, I am, actually. I'm sitting over here in the corner going, oh, scratching my nuts.
None of it would have been possible without Keynes, though.
What now?
Our entire last 100 years of our country wouldn't have been possible without Lord John Maynard Keynes.
And his stupid book. What was the
General
name?
Theory.
General Theory, and there's also the Cost of Peace, mm-hmm. The Economic Consequences of Peace.
He gave government license for the first time in history to look at the economy as something that you turn dials. And when he did, it has been our downfall ever since. All of our bubbles, all of these things, granted, inflation can happen. It can absolutely happen when an economy overheats and people get speculative and think it's a really good investment to invest there. A lot of money pours in. But he gave the government license to create the Fed in order to just say, well, we'll just do quantitative easing. We'll prop up the economy. Realistically, the fundamentals of our economy are no better than during the crash. But we've printed enough money, it looks like the visualization is like a ping pong ball floating on water. When employment's way down, we'll just fill up the bucket with more water and make it look like it's rising. And that was the justification of big government in our downfall.
But doesn't that water have to come from somewhere, Greg?
Oh, yeah. We can make it out of...
Yeah, we can just make new water.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. No.
It's a scam.
Yeah. All right. So now that we've given our history lesson for the day, let's continue on. This Syria thing has so many layers, and one of them is Putin and Russia. Russia traditionally, I mean, all the way back for hundreds of years, Russia has always been like the red-headed stepchild on the world stage. You know, they've been important, but they've never been, you know, probably the closest that they've ever been was the superpower days of the Cold War. But they've always kind of been second tier. And they've always been pushed around. And they've always been, you know, tread upon.
But they were the envy of the intellectual world in 1920, 1910. Leon Trotsky.
Yes. And so what
your art was also pretty awesome around that time.
Mm-hmm.
I like the blocks and all that. And what I think one of the reasons Putin is popular is that Putin is the type of guy who is that Ronald Reagan figure.
National pride leader.
And by that I mean he instills national pride and says Russia can be great again.
Never stop being great, and I don't know why you're not walking tall.
Right.
Why aren't you celebrating in your breadlines?
Mm-hmm. I will wrestle a bear to death.
As he lectures us on American exceptionalism.
Right.
By a New York Times op-ed.
I knew that.
You saw that.
I knew that'd get you. I've got it right in front of me. So Vladimir Putin has really come out. He's been very successful in all of the Syria stuff. At every turn, he is playing a chess match, and he just seems to be checkmating Barack Obama in the PR department. And he capitalizes on things like the gaffe that Kerry makes. If that wasn't all pre-planned in some way, Putin and Assad seized it. And the morning of Barack Obama's big speech, Tuesday, they put out a statement saying, you know, hey, John Kerry's idea, we're going to go with it. We're going to turn over all of our weapons. Assad signs the chemical weapons ban today at the UN. And Putin looks like the maker of peace. You know, here's a guy who's a former KGB agent. He's probably killed hundreds of people with his bare hands. And he's killed tens of thousands of Chechens. Yes. He has a horrendous record when it comes to human rights. This program and this commentator have in previous episodes of We the Libertarians called him the next great dictator. I think it's in the show notes, so you probably can search it. Because he is just a bad person. Here's a guy who invaded Georgia. Do you remember Saakashvili and pleading on national TV with George Bush to help save him from Russia because the Russians invaded Georgia for their resources? Putin is not a good guy. Putin is a very, very bad human being.
He's an Alexander the Great type.
Yes. Explain that.
He sees he misses the Soviet Union. He is very vain. He's very proud of his Russian heritage. And he sees a world ripe for, I guess, expansion for Russia. He sees Europe that's in decay. There's a large amount of civil unrest that's probably not reported a lot in London and France. They've had very open immigration policies, and there's pockets of both countries that have Sharia law. He sees order can be imposed through fear.
Wait a second. Did you just say there are pockets of Great Britain that are under Sharia law?
London. Not Great Britain. London. There are parts of London that are under Sharia law.
Parts of the city?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
That where police will not go into.
Wow.
They have been so so open borders, if you will, about their immigration policy that, I mean, in France, they call it the Browning of France, which is like one of the most racist things I've ever heard. But
there's very, I mean,
the Algerians.
Geert Wilders. Mm-hmm. Like, Geert Wilders is this parliamentarian from Sweden?
I'm not positive, actually.
That's the Netherlands. And he's like one of the most racist anti-Muslim people on the planet. And there's a very strong sense of anti-Muslim sentiment because people are fleeing the Middle East for obvious reasons, and they're heading to places with stable economies, i.e. Europe.
But the crazies are following them and taking control in those communities. That's the issue.
Okay.
And using fear.
And we're bitching about the Mexicans coming to do the jobs that most of us won't fill.
I mean, I know that we hate Canada, but realistically, we have two of the greatest neighbors in the world.
Listen, white people are terrible.
Them and their maple syrup and their Mountie hats.
You take your faux bacon and get the hell out of here.
It is faux bacon. I agree. There's nothing bacon about Canadian bacon.
I'm sorry. You're posers. And hockey sucks.
Okay, wait a second. So you were telling me about, you were waxing poetic about Putin and
Chris feels much more strongly than I do. I don't think it's possible for a strong man to arise out of Russia like a Putin. He's got the potentiality for a dictator, but with China being the 800-pound gorilla in that hemisphere, he can't do it.
Putin has control of Europe. And nobody wants to admit it, but his natural gas and oil pipelines control Europe.
That's interesting you bring that up. Who do you think the biggest funding of the Syrian rebels is in the world?
It's not going to be us.
Mm-mm.
Let's see. I'm going to go with Qatar.
Yep. Qatar has spent $4 billion on the rebels.
Hey, didn't Qatar start Al Jazeera?
Yep.
And don't they have control over most of the media, and they're the CNN of the Middle Eastern world, and now, then they just start in America?
Yeah, and why do you think they would have a vested interest in the Syrian rebels winning?
Could it be pipelines?
A natural gas pipeline that would go through Syria and supply Europe and be a competitor.
You just blew my mind. Hold on.
Who do you think was visiting with Vladimir Putin last week?
Oh, my God.
A member of the House of Saud of Saudi Arabia who met with him and then talked about, we need to find a resolution to this because with the Olympics coming up, you'd hate to have civil unrest. And I'd hate for a, I believe their name's pronounced Seiko, but I thought it was Psycho at the time. Because they're a fundamentalist, they're an Islamic fundamentalist group that he has funding, that he funds and can control and can cause civil unrest during the Olympics, in addition to funding the Chechenian rebels and causing an absolute stir for the Winter Olympics. It's a year away, and he was threatening Vladimir Putin, and Putin, of course, responds, well, this is something that we'll need further conversation. He flies back to Saudi Arabia and gives the okay to just unleash funds to the Syrian rebels, who will then, in fact, allow said pipeline to be built into Europe. This is a resource war that no one's talking about.
Right, because what they want is no one wants Russia to have sole control over the natural resource flow to all of Europe. They don't want the Russians to have that kind of control. And so America and Qatar, Qatar being a more moderate Islamic state, obviously, and friendly to the United States.
Yeah, very. They're pragmatic. They're interested in making money.
Right. And they understand that, you know, Dubai, UAE, Kuwait, all these moderate Arab states that are oil rich, it's in their interest to partner with the United States so we can buy the their oil. And you look at the building in Dubai, that's all American money. That's all from your gas tank. It's the greatest wealth redistribution on the face of the planet has happened over the last few years.
It's like Maya said, if we had used hemp seed oil in the Model T, they would still be leaving in tents in 130-degree weather.
Instead of the tallest buildings in the world.
Yeah.
Fact, yeah.
So that is the real reason that Syria is such a such an important actor on the world stage, because it's control of Europe.
Oh, yeah, and Saudi Arabia plays a vital part because at the drop of a hat, they can turn Muslim extremism and the focus on Israel instead of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So they are one of our allies, and if we do anything that is perceived as anti this pipeline being built, guess where funding is going to start going and start marching towards? Our greatest proxy in the Middle East. And damn, suck us into a war.
Let's talk about the Putin, and I don't know if you've read the Putin op-ed, either of you.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly is interesting. Let's kind of take a few of the points and pull it out of here and talk about it. You know, Putin, which is sort of an I don't want to say unprecedented, but has a leader of Russia ever put something in an American newspaper like this? You know, I
unless Gorbachev might have, you know, because he had a decent relationship.
But it wouldn't have been as, I mean, Gorbachev seemed like he was pretty much a puppet of the West.
Yeah, yeah, he did. But so he might have published something. But
right.
Realistically.
But it didn't have this kind of impact, this kind of cachet.
No, this is way more influential than anything Gorbachev would have done.
You know, senators are calling this op-ed. Menendez said that it made him vomit. Johnny Isaacson? No, it was Inhofe. Inhofe said that Ronald Reagan would be spinning in his grave. Boehner found it extremely distasteful, and the White House referred all questions to Putin. So
you have to ask Putin on that one.
Right, yeah. Never to ask poot-poot a single question.
According to W, old Pooty Poot.
So Barry was like, you have to take that up with Poot Poot. Yeah.
All kudos go to Slate Magazine for the headline of the week. Putin on a sod face.
Oh,
so bad.
Oh, yeah.
Putin on Assad face.
Slate does a wonderful job of titling their articles. I have to give them that.
Yep, their headline writer needs a raise.
Shouldn't George W. Bush be more influential in this? Because the last time I checked, he had seen into his soul, so he could read his actions. But he has not been consulted.
What are you talking about?
Don't you remember that? He said that he could see into Vladimir Putin's soul.
Yeah, Bush, yeah.
That was a direct quote from W.
He's a great leader in the world.
When I'm looking for insight on the soul of world leaders, it's Dubya that I want to consult with.
Well, if you believe he's the great Satan, then why not? They're probably brother and sister.
Well, there was, you know, there was, they had a great relationship with, not Gorbachev, but Yeltsin.
Mm-hmm.
I meant to say Yeltsin was the puppet of the world, not Gorbachev, by the way. You know, and then there were lots of hopes for Pooty Poot, and... You know,
like
then that
cereal.
Whole, like, killing of tens of thousands of your citizens, and then there was the poisoning and murdering of journalists and the imprisoning of businessmen and political opponents. And
who
then
you created as oligarchs.
And then invading other countries. That sort of all soured the relationship, you know?
That'll do it, yeah.
Nobody gives anybody a break in the world anymore. You invade one country, geez.
Liberate.
Yeah.
Start one little world war.
Right. So
suddenly nobody invites you to the party.
Let me read a couple passages here, and then we'll talk about the UN and if it means anything anymore. Relations between us have passed through different stages. We stood against each other during the Cold War, but we were also allies once and defeated the Nazis together. The Universal International Organization, the UN, was then established to prevent such devastation from ever happening again. The United States founders understood, thank you for lecturing us on our founders, by the way, understood that decisions affecting war and peace should happen only by consensus and with America's consent, the veto by Security Council permanent members was enshrined in the UN Charter. The profound wisdom of this has underpinned the stability of international relations for decades. Really? No one wants that. The really was my commentary, by the way. He didn't sass himself.
Putin was like, really?
He was like, really? I'm right? Really? No one wants the UN to suffer the fate of the League of Nations, which collapsed because it lacked real leverage. This is possible if influential countries bypass the UN and take military action without Security Council authorization. The probably one of the most telling moments in this was when Barack Obama said in Sweden, or the G8, I think he was at the G8 in Russia, you know, what are we going to do? Are we going to go to the UN and dance around with all this hocus pocus and all these treaties and all these things that don't matter anymore? I mean, to me, if Bush had said that, I would have been like, no big deal. You know, Bush has disdained conservatives.
He's a cowboy.
Don't like the UN, even though the UN Security Council passed many, many resolutions condemning Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And there were many, many years of resolutions in the UN against Iraq. There haven't really been any with Syria just because of Russia and China wanting to veto them all. When Barack Obama comes out and says that the UN and the Security Council is hocus pocus, I think that's significant. And that kind of says that the UN is really, in the United States, which is its biggest funder, we really don't lend it a lot of credibility anymore.
Yeah. Well, it has no enforcement mechanism, so how can you be credible?
Right.
Well, there is no international law. There is no international structure. There's nothing that is universally applied on our planet.
Are you trying to say the Hague isn't binding?
Well, there is international law. There is international law. There's these treaties and these binding resolutions.
Those are international agreements, but that's not international law. Not every nation signed off on that. So, in other words, like, if Iceland gets, like, froggy and decides that they are going to attack things.
Oh, I thought you meant they were going to get French, like, froggy.
Oh,
like...
I mean, maybe. Maybe that's what they're going to attack. So they're going to get froggy and attack France. And then
I support
Iceland,
that decision.
Yes. So then frozen French fries are going to become all the new rage. But what I'm saying is no amount of treaties The current amount of treaties that we have...
Just no amount was
treaties
correct,
are words on paper, and as long as incentives are aligned,
right?
Yeah,
like as a global phenomenon, we have a difficult time agreeing to rules even in small areas. So every time that you have a city council meeting where people disagree on things, that is people not agreeing on what the law should be locally. Then you expand that to your state and your nation, and then you realize that other nations don't agree with your nation, and there's absolutely very little hope for international law to ever arise.
Right. International law exists. It's just who's going to enforce it?
Why would you either? Why would you why would you grant sovereignty to an institution which is more often than not not going to rule in your national interest?
Have you ever served on a board, either of you?
Yeah. I'm against any kind of collectivism, including boards.
I have not served on boards, but I have been very instrumental in preparing
I have
for boards.
Many, many boards.
In my time, yeah. I have been on boards. I have worked for boards of nonprofits. And
oh, nonprofits. I thought you meant money.
No. Nonprofit boards. You know, when you work in a corporation, you work for a company, and let's say you work for Chase Bank, Jamie Dimon gets to walk around and says what he says goes. But when you work in a team, a collaboration, and everyone has an equal vote, you know how maddening that is with 10 people?
Oh, Chris, you mean it's not important that we all create consensus and everybody gets on the same page?
Right. I can't imagine what that's like with 180 countries trying to all have an equal voice.
And Uzbekistan's getting really pissed off.
Right. That's where Putin, and we'll talk about this later, Uzbekistan ain't got crap on the United States of America. Snaps in the form of a Z.
From now on, we're calling her Uzbeki.
Uzbeki.
Uzbeki, Becky, Bekistan. That's my Herman Cain impression.
He would have handled this situation more effectively than the president.
I
don't care what you said. He could have bought people off for pizza.
Hold on, I can't right now. No.
It could not. Well, let me preface this by saying it could. This is either brilliance or total mishandling and
An abomination.
It's an abomination, or it's brilliant. One of the two. One of the two.
I listened to the, as I've said many times, the Jamie Dupree podcast, where he's interviewed by Herman Cain, and Jamie is the Cox News reporter for the Cox media outlet, and has a lot of good insights. And Herman doesn't. And Herman's like, Jamie, I've got some ideas on all the serious stuff. It's a mess. I'm like, that's his big commentary on Syria. Oh, this is a mess.
Yeah.
Oh, Herman.
I know. Herman is not well suited to nuance.
Yeah.
But he absolutely is a businessman. There's no debating that.
What was your abomination you were going to drop on us?
No, I mean, like the way, no, I'm saying, I was saying, this is either total brilliance on Barack Obama's part, or it is an abomination of mishandling of epic proportions, which
you just mean his response to the series.
Yeah, I don't know which one it is, because this point, there's no middle ground. It's either brilliant, or it is an absolute travesty. It's going to trigger World 3.
So after Rwanda, after Iraq, and now after Syria, is there any purpose and point to the United Nations at this point?
I mean, they're decorative.
Jobs program.
They made a decent set of targets for whomever picked them off in Syria.
Yep.
Sorry, that was totally disrespectful.
Well,
how dare you?
If people will agree, I do see a role for them as far as inspecting crime scenes, but that assumes they get full access, which they never do.
Which they never, ever do.
They're a theoretical organization.
They're an imaginary organization. It's a very expensive imaginary organization, which we have primarily funded and refused to support. I mean, we're as much to blame for the lack of effectivity of the UN as anyone. We was it the Wilsons or the... No, it was the Roosevelts, right? That created the UN.
The United Nations?
Yeah, we're very instrumental in...
I thought it was Truman with Israel in the 40s.
I thought it was
Spengler,
the
Roosevelt. You're a history buff. The United Nations, who was the thought leader behind that? Which president?
It was Truman.
Truman, yeah.
Truman formed the United Nations.
Mm. What did the Roosevelts form?
Roosevelt died.
The New Deal?
Roosevelt, the war was going on in the middle, and the United Nations was formed by Truman out of the peace. And
see, I was thinking
intellectually, it might have been FDR. He might have started formulating it, but he was no longer.
Roosevelt was very instrumental.
She
was still alive.
Everything materialized under Truman.
Okay.
Okay. So onward in the Pooty Poot op-ed in the New York Times.
Pooty Poot.
The potential strike by the United States. By the way, just so you all know, Putin put out a statement today. He wrote all this by himself. No one else wrote this for him.
While wrestling a bear.
Unconfirmed rumors that he did it while wrestling a bear.
Okay.
Nude. The potential strike by the United States against Syria, despite strong opposition from many countries and major political and religious leaders, including the Pope, boom, will result in more innocent victims and escalation potentially spreading the conflict far beyond Syria's borders. A strike would increase violence and unleash a new wave of terrorism. It would undermine the multilateral efforts to resolve the Iranian nuclear program and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and further destabilize the Middle East and North Africa. It would throw the balance of the entire system of international law and order out of balance. Syria is not witnessing a battle for democracy, but an armed conflict between government and opposition in a multi-religious country. There are a few champions of democracy in Syria, but there are more than enough Qaeda fighters and extremists of all stripes battling the government. The U.S. State Department has designated the Al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant fighting with the opposition as terrorist organizations. Let me read that again. Because yesterday, 9/11,
ouch,
was the day that arms began flowing to the Syrian rebels.
Oh, wow.
In 2013. So let me read that again. The United States...
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I didn't hear about that.
The United State Department has designated Al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, the fighting with the opposition, as terrorist organizations.
Tasteless.
This internal conflict, fueled by foreign weapons, supplied to the opposition... is one of the bloodiest in the world.
You have to give me a minute. That really pisses me off.
Yeah. Mercenaries from Arab countries fighting there and hundreds of militants from Western countries and even Russia are an issue of our deep concern. Might they not return to our countries with experience acquired in Syria? After all, after fighting in Libya, extremists move on to Mali. This threatens us all. So we've talked about that. He's making the case. He's clearly a listener to We Are Libertarians. He's making the case that we have made time and time again how despicable it is that we would fund people that...
call us the Great Satan.
Call us the Great Satan. You know, you had a piece on WeAreLibertarians.com this week where you talked about the importance of Syria. Fill us in a little bit about what that was about.
I have been working on an article for about the last 3 months. It's something... I stumbled upon during actually the Boston bombing when the older brother, Sarnev's older brother, whose name's escaping me at the moment, his YouTube account.
Tamerlan.
His YouTube account, they actually could see the videos he watched. One of those videos was called The Black Banners of the Greater Khorasan Army. I had never heard of it at all. And so I decided to start doing some investigation. And there's a Hadith. And the Hadiths are actually oral traditions of Muhammad. The way they're rated is based on the credibility of the person that talked of the oral tradition. And so one of the Hadiths that's authenticity is disputed is if you see the black banners coming from the direction of Khorasan, then go to them, even if you have to crawl, because among them will be Allah's Caliph, the Mahdi. Now, what do the black banners represent? The black banners represent the prophesied Khorasan army. And Khorasan is modern-day Iran and Afghanistan. There are two types of flags in Islam. There are actually a white flag with black lettering, okay? And there's also a black flag with white lettering. And that is the flag of the military, the greater Khorasan army that's prophesied will come, march towards Israel, and then... be essentially indestructible so they can install the caliphate, which in Islam is a global Islamic government under Allah. It's essentially heaven on earth. It's their end point. Now, who's the Mahdi? In Islam, the Mahdi is actually not the savior. He's the one who comes before God or Allah's peace on earth and Allah's government. Jesus Christ comes back and defeats the Antichrist. Names Isa in the Quran. And the Mahdi comes back with Christ, and Jesus appears. Guess where he appears at? Where? Damascus. That is where he returns on earth, is in Damascus.
And what's the Mahdi?
The Mahdi is, he is someone, if you are a Shia Muslim, you believe he's been alive for quite some time and been dormant, but he is a direct descendant of Muhammad, dating all the way back to Muhammad's daughter, Fatima. goes all the way back to the split of Sunni and Shia Muslims. But one thing I think has been forgotten in all of this, and I'm not going to give you a history lesson, but...
You kind of are.
I know, I'm sorry. I won't do it. You can cut cut that part out.
No, I think it's great.
One thing that's been lost on all this is religion. Even India and Kashmir, between India and Pakistan, that is a war of religion. This is a war of religion. It's my opinion that ever since Osama bin Laden was funded by the United States in Afghanistan to fight back against Russia, we have been actively funding the Islamic end days. Osama bin Laden goes to Saudi Arabia. He's connected to the House of Saud. And after the Kuwait invasion by Iraq, right before the Saudi royal family decides to take U.S. help, he volunteers to raise essentially a Muslim army to fight them back so that they can show that they can secure their homeland. Instead, the Saudi royal family decides to invite the United States in, and Osama bin Laden says to them that if they come, they will never leave. And that's something Spangles said.
Yeah, and guess what?
We've never left.
We've never left.
Now, we're there for resources, and because we put Israel on the absolute hotbed of all warfare in the history of the world. But so, Osama bin Laden then flees to the Sudan. He flees to the Sudan, and then the United States starts putting pressure on the Saudi royal family and other government institutions to get them out of there. But what's often missed is how Osama bin Laden became so fundamental. The way he became so fundamental is while he was in Saudi Arabia studying, he fell under the influence of a man named Muhammad Qutb, whose brother was Saeed Qutb, the most influential member of jihadism. Up until Saeed Qutb, jihadism had always been, I guess, similar to the NAP. Do not strike until you've been hit. He granted intellectual credence to the idea that you should actively promote jihad. You should go out and wage holy wars and try to convert. It had never had that before. And also, Islam had never been about anywhere outside of the Arabian Peninsula. The Middle East, we're concerned with our own interests. Until Saeed Qutb creates this intellectual framework of pursuing jihad and then also creating transnational government parties, which just so happened to be the Muslim Brotherhood. That's what he was a founding member of, the Muslim Brotherhood under Banna. They have been working to pursue this idea that Al-Qaeda represents the Greater Khorasan Army. When Osama bin Laden is forced to flee the Sudan because of international pressures, he specifically chose Afghanistan because that is modern-day Khorasan. He picked it because he wanted to bring about the end days as are understood in Islam. In Islam, and this is only among a small sect, keep in mind, this isn't all of Islam. These are the extreme fundamentalists who think that they can actively bring about the Mahdi and the return of peace on earth under Islam. So he goes to Afghanistan. He starts goes back to Afghanistan after leaving when he fought against the Russians, starts raising money, thinks the Taliban is the only Muslim group, governmental entity that is committed towards promoting the end of days. And that's why he allies with them. He wins quite a few wars. He attacks the USS Cole, 9/11. Thing. Clinton had a chance to take him out in the Sudan and did not. He is a guy that escaped he escaped the U.S. surveillance state, which they catch everything, and he still managed to do it until Barack Obama issued the order to take him down in Pakistan. Right. And the Muslim Brotherhood has seen a rise. For the longest time, they were seen as a terrorist organization as well. What they did is they worked to promote the government institutions necessary to rule. They were seen as someone who, yes, they wanted Sharia law, but they were open to coming about democratically. As you see in Egypt after the revolution, what government institutions were readily available to assume power?
After what?
After the first revolution, after Morsi, the first, the guy that
Mubarak.
Mubarak. What institution was readily there to just assume
the Muslim
power?
The Muslim Brotherhood, because the military was discredited in Egypt.
They already had the framework for the constitution written. They had the government institutions in place. They just walked in, set up shop, and looked like a reasonable alternative.
Right.
The United States had given them license to do it because we saw it as an opportunity to open up discussion with the Muslim world.
Oops.
Funny part is...
this is going to be hilarious.
And this
tell.
Is the great part. This is all being coordinated by Osama bin Laden because he actively believes that he can bring about an Islamic caliphate and that Jesus will come back in Damascus. So he makes the Al-Qaeda flag an exact replica of the prophesied army of the greater army of Khorasan.
Wow.
Everything is intertwined in religion in this, and this is something that is not being talked about. And if you look, I said on the last episode, or maybe the episode before, the entire continent of Africa looks like it is ripe for a caliphate. Tunisia, Libya, Sudan, South Sudan, Eritrea, Somalia, Morocco, the Arabian Peninsula for sure.
Yeah, the Northern Horn.
I almost want to give them enough leash to catch Kony and yep. then crack down on them.
Nigeria, if you can call it the Republic of Congo. That is an entire continent that looks like it is primed for civic upheaval. And then the only organized institutions over there is the Muslim Brotherhood. They're transnational. And they had never been till Saeed Qutb wrote, and he came to the United States. He taught at Colorado State University. And while he was over here, he saw what he thought was an absolute decay in civilization. And that's when Islam took a turn for the worse and became very strict, very fundamentalist.
Well, who took him to the strip clubs?
Well, yeah.
I mean, that
those
was
crazy
decision,
Colorado
guys.
State Rams.
Right.
So what does all this mean?
So what it means is that they think the last point of their end days is... And even in the Christian world, even in Revelations, that's the whole other side of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Isaiah, Damascus, right before the end times falls and is destroyed. In Islam, that's where Isa, Jesus, returns and beats the Antichrist. And then the Mahdi essentially acts as Allah's agent on earth and installs the caliphate. And these people, it's my opinion, these people believe that can be done.
There's some prophecy about the bear, which means Russia.
Gog and Magog. Russia and the United States.
You know, yeah. So it's an interesting view. So it's all bad.
Just to give you an idea, this is Al-Qaeda's stated purpose. If you think this is crazy, that's fine. I don't think it's crazy.
I don't think you're trying to float a conspiracy theory. I think you're trying to give context.
Yeah,
to what the thinking is of our opponents.
Yeah, we are fighting a religious war, and we have no idea. We have no idea the stakes. We're acting like this is something that can be controlled. So by supporting the ANR, which we talked about earlier, they are an organization that is supported by Al-Qaeda.
ANR meaning Al-Nusra.
Yeah. So the exact principles of Al-Qaeda are to provoke the United States and the West into invading a Muslim country by staging a massive attack or string of attacks that result in massive civilian casualties, 9/11. Incite local resistance to occupying forces, the Arab Spring.
Right.
Expand the conflict to neighboring countries and engage the U.S. and its allies in a long war of attrition.
Hmm.
Whether it's Iraq or Egypt, regardless,
right.
One of the two. Convert Al-Qaeda into an ideology instead of operating principles that can be loosely franchised into other countries. The Syrian rebels. The U.S. economy will finally collapse by year 2020 under the strain of multiple engagements in numerous places, making the worldwide economic system, which is dependent on the U.S., also collapse, leading into global political instability, which in turn leads to a global jihad led by Al-Qaeda, and a caliphate will then be installed across the world following the collapse of the U.S. and the rest of the Western world countries.
Well, that just doesn't suit my schedule, kid.
Yeah, economic collapse of the United States by 2020.
I mean...
That doesn't sound good.
And what's even worse...
It's ambitious.
...is this was all staged on a hadith, an oral tradition of Islam that is highly contestable. It's probably 80-20, the number of Muslim scholars that believe this was actually credible. 80-20 against.
Right.
But because Osama bin Laden became so obsessed with religion, while he was under Muhammad Qutb, Sayyid Qutb's brother, one of the founding members of the Muslim Brotherhood.
And he had money.
And he had money. He took this to heart and saw a way for him to, one, create prophecy, and two, ensure that his influence was something on a global stage. It's nothing more than the inclination to control, right, just like we talked about in this earlier episode.
Yep, absolutely. Well, that's very interesting. I think it's an interesting view into what Al-Qaeda thinks. And I think we, after 12 years, we've lost the desire to understand what's going on because the wars are winding down, the wars are over, you know, supposedly, even though we're droning all over the place. But they're not really over. You see all that's going on over there, and I think that's a lot of what Putin is saying. I mean, Putin is fighting Islamic extremism in Chechnya. Now, that's because he's a monster, and he is trying to control that region for resources and is ruthless about it.
So what we're really seeing is an economic war versus a religious war.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have two any more hotter things than that, you talk about the end of days.
Yep. So
no, thank you.
Yeah. Let's wrap up with American exceptionalism real quick. My working and personal relationship with President Obama is marked by growing trust. I appreciate this. I carefully studied his address to the nation on Tuesday, and I would rather disagree with the case he made on American exceptionalism, stating that the U.S. policy is what makes America different. It's what makes us exceptional. It is extremely dangerous to encourage people to see themselves as exceptional, whatever the motivation. There are big countries and small countries, rich and poor, those with long democratic traditions and those still finding their way to democracy. Their policies differ too. We're all different, but when we ask for the Lord's blessing, we must not forget God created us equal. So let me break that down a little bit and give you my point of view on it. I don't really expect the leader of another country to say that America is the only exceptional nation. You know, Barack Obama got in trouble when he said, you know, of course, this country thinks that Sweden's an exceptional nation, and I think America is an exceptional nation. Every leader of a country thinks their nation is exceptional, just like every governor says their state is the best. You know, that's just how it is. Like, We're Libertarians is way better than any other libertarian podcast ever.
Yeah, but that's a directive from God.
That's right. So I don't quibble with that. Of course he's going to say that we're not exceptional.
I don't think that's what he's saying.
He's saying that
we're not special.
I think he's reminding the American people that we are not bulletproof and can also explode.
There could certainly be part of that. And there's also a bit of don't be so full of yourselves and don't be so arrogant.
These are all good pieces of advice, though.
Yeah, saying, you know, it is extremely dangerous to encourage people to see themselves as exceptional, whatever the motivation. Because why? That would create a sense of entitlement. If you have a friend who was told by their parents that they were a gift from God, what do they turn into? They turn into a bunch of spoiled brats that think they can run everything.
I don't know. I think one thing I've always hated about exceptionalism is that bastardizes the word. Exceptional means you are exception to the rule.
Mm-hmm.
We are the exception to the rule because we, through off-colonial rule, created a system of government that allowed for political freedom.
That's right.
That allowed for religious freedom, that created small government without a tyrannical leader. George Washington, if he wanted to, could have been king. He decided mm-hmm. against it. In history, we are the exception to the rule. It doesn't mean we think we're great. It's just an accurate identifier that we didn't pursue the route of a tyrannical regime.
When I hear people talk about American exceptionalism, they always talk about the founding, 250 years ago, 270 years ago. What about us today is exceptional?
We are the rule now. We are no longer the exception.
Right. That,
no,
I think...
Personally, okay, you were just speaking earlier about, you know, control and how you can lose by trying to control certain elements and you can lose your sense of
self.
Perspective and self. Absolutely. And I think that one of the ways that... And intellectualism, that was where you were going. And I think that one of the ways that we kind of stifle ourselves is that we tend to think of certain ideologies as sciences. So like with propaganda, for example, let's say Spengel has studied propaganda inside out, backwards and upside down. And so he'll read a headline and assume that it was intended to convey a certain message. Whereas I wrote the headline, don't about propaganda, and just wrote it the way I wanted it to be. So here's Spengel sitting on one set end of the couch, assuming that, you know, my intention was this one option A, when the reality was my intention was option B, but because his science has told him that the reason that I did this was to mask something else, or the ideology that he reveres as a science, then I would appear to be an exception to the rule, when really, in actuality, it is that his ideology is not a true science so much as a philosophy or a way
set of guidelines to interpret something. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So to say that we are the exception because we are the ones that set up our own democracy and didn't go the kingdom
republic.
Route. Okay, set up our own
they
republic.
They debated it. I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah. I'm Democratic just trying to republic. Make sure that every libertarian doesn't write us, where does she know that it's a republic?
Good call.
By the way, are you eating a pork chop?
I am eating a manly pork chop. You're
eating
like peas? A bear-sized pork chop.
Pork chop, peas, and macaroni and cheese.
Yeah.
She's
a
Hoosier.
It's exceptional. It's American and exceptional.
I just look over and all of a sudden she pops out her Tupperware and starts eating a dinner.
Well, you started telling me about us arming the Syrians on 9/11, and I was like, where's my comfort food? Get me a Mountain
just
Dew.
Just so we're clear, though, cow always beats pig.
That's right.
The Tao of Swanson.
Producers, kids.
The pig is a dirty animal.
Yep.
So, all right. All countries equal?
Nope.
Not a chance. Sorry. I mean, you're telling me that the American system of government
now, the value of each human within those countries should be equal.
100%.
Right.
We agree on that. Okay. But should we be on equal currency footing with Afghanistan?
Probably
no.
Not.
Do we try our best to treat all people with respect and equality and give everyone justice?
Yes.
Yes. That's what we aspire to. Do we achieve that? No. Other countries, they instill inequality, injustice. They're anti-liberty.
But there's a little wrinkle there, because the United States and the West interprets equality through negative liberty, by what your government can't do to you. The East, Russia and China, looks at the West and says, are your people really equal? Are they really free? They're enslaved by their vices. They're enslaved by behaviors that aren't productive to what you're trying to achieve. We look at Russia and China and say, look how you treat your citizens. You run over people with tanks in Tiananmen Square. You black bag people and put them in labor camps in the Soviet Union. But what they see as the thing to pursue is uniformity, is greatness, is that that perfect race, that strength. Where we see it as, how do you treat people to make sure that they can live the most unencumbered? So that's always been the dilemma between the West and the East, is how you actually view human freedom. Is it positive liberty or negative?
Right. Just to wrap up, because we're getting
sorry,
late
I didn't
here.
Mean to.
No,
go
you
on.
Didn't.
Yeah,
you
like
didn't go off on a tangent. I'm just thinking about all the editing that I have to do now that Gina's back.
You're welcome.
By the way, Pooty Poot, nobody is buying the Lord's blessings and God created us equal stuff. You're an ex-KGB agent. You murder people for fun. You're a total a-hole, and you look like a ferret.
And to say that you don't love nationalism, pot, kettle, black.
Hello, me, yeah. I think that line about the Lord's blessings and God created us equal, I think that Putin thinks that all Americans are just Tea Partiers.
Right.
Like, everybody is just an overweight, middle-class...
W supporter
with
waiting
the...
for the rapture, baby.
The Tea Party starter kit from Cracker Barrel. Like, I think he just thinks we're all, like, you know, the Tea Party.
That might be true, that they may have started this at Cracker Barrel. I never thought of that, but good point.
Oh, please. You go to your Cracker Barrel. Your local Cracker Barrel has everything you need to start a Tea Party. Okay? It has the straw hat with the American flag banding. It has... T-shirts with American Eagles on it. Everything you need for the tea party, it's right there at your local Cracker Barrel, so be sure to stop in.
But really, what can't you buy at Cracker Barrel?
I know. I love to shop and eat at the same time.
That's classy.
I'm just saying, if Cracker Barrel delivered, they'd make a fortune off of me, and I'd need a scooter, one of those scooters. So probably wouldn't be able to get around Cracker Barrel without knocking something down. All right. It has been an excellent show, but also a long show, so we better wrap up here.
Wrapping it up.
So, anything that you thought we missed, any final thoughts that you'd like to touch on again, anything you'd like to promote, let us start with the lovely, triumphantly returning Gina Martinez.
No, it was a great show. Thank you, guys. I can't think of... I mean, there's a ton of things that I should be promoting, but...
Your column?
I know. Oh, well, it's not really a column yet, so right now I'm in discussions with Nouveau and...
You wrote a column. Opinion piece.
I wrote a blog as a matter of the guest voices section under Nouveau.
Please, you are not a blogger. You are an opinion writer.
True.
If you don't
I am
promote yourself, then no one will promote you.
She's the libertarian Michelle Malkin.
Ooh, yuck. But if you do check the article out, be forewarned that it rambles a little and doesn't make a very stringent point.
No, it's very good.
It's very angry.
It is rather angry, and it does its job, I think. It provokes
America.
Conversation.
Greg Lenz.
No, the only thing I didn't tie together on Syria, and I'm sorry I rambled on that point, was that Al-Qaeda is the military arm of the caliphate, and the Muslim Brotherhood is the governing arm in the institutions. That's how those two intermingle.
Mm. Right on.
Okay, racist. All right. I'm just kidding.
I don't care.
I'll spank his brow.
I don't care.
Yes.
I'll sit over there in the sand and wait for a guy on a flying horse to come down and mock him publicly all day.
My final thought is the Judiciary Committee today, they struck a deal to define what is and is not a journalist. If you want to check out the story, you can go to my Facebook page. It's facebook.com/chris.spangle, S-P-A-N-G-L-E. Or you can go to Roll Call's blog, WGDB, stands for World's Greatest Deliberative Body. And they wrote the article at about 10 o'clock on September 12th. And the Judiciary Committee, which is Pat Leahy, DiFi, Dick Durbin, Chuck Schumer, Lindsey Graham, all the best senators got together today. John Cornyn, who actually tried to offer an amendment to expand the scope so it wouldn't be anti-constitutional. But all the progressive Republicans and Democrats got together. And here is the definition of who is now a journalist, according to the Judiciary Committee, if this eventually gets passed. As now amended, the legislation would include individuals who have been employed as journalists by media organizations for at least 1 year in a two-decade period, or at least three months within the five-year window, along with student journalists and those with a substantial amount of freelancer work. This means that bloggers, people who haven't worked in journalism for over a year, they're all not covered by the First Amendment, and that they can then be prosecuted by things like the Espionage Act. So,
Michael Hastings,
all that stuff that we talked about earlier with Woodrow Wilson, yeah. So share that, spread the word, you know. People like the... Now, I'm covered because I worked at a news station for 4 years as a reporter. And so, hopefully, We Are Libertarians would be covered under this statute because I am the publisher and the editor-in-chief, the head honcho of the Hacienda around here. And so, hopefully, my experience will blanket cover all of you.
I don't care. Opinions aren't illegal.
Yeah.
They can screw themselves
if
they think they are.
They are illegal now.
No, they're not.
You're not allowed to have an opinion. You can have an opinion, you just can't write about it.
Yeah.
Really, this is just a crackdown on people like Edward Snowden, but it's always scary when they start trying to define things that should be covered by the First Amendment. So kudos to John Cornyn for at least trying, but he still failed. So, all right, that is the end of this episode. We hope that you have found it interesting. We hope that you have found it enlightening and worthy of a share on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, if you still do that, maybe even LinkedIn. You know, Friendster, MySpace, whatever you got. email it out, even if it, you can fax the podcast to someone and let them have a listen. So we really appreciate
free Bahamian vacation and a podcast.
Exactly. All the people who share it, all the people who write in and tell us that they like the show, that they listen to the show, even the people who write in with constructive criticism about how the show sucks. That helps us too, but try to limit that to one year. And we also like the people who write in with questions. We like to answer some questions sometimes. So hit me up at editor@wearelibertarians.com or go to our contact page. So thank you for listening to this episode of We Are Libertarians. This is Chris Spangle for Greg Lenz and Gina Martinez and all those who are missing in action named Creighton Harrington. Next week, we promise
to do better next time.
Music for We Are Libertarians is provided by Hoosier musician Brian Keith Wallen. Please check out his website, briankeithwallen.com. The song is Bad Spell.